Hello from Midori House in London and a very warm welcome to Sunday Brunch. We're live here on Monocle 24 with me, Emma Nelson. Coming up on today's programme, Glitter, Glamour and Tease. The world's biggest burlesque festival lands in London. We put our tassels on. Also coming up, the world's most diverse art fair takes over Dubai. We'll hear from a very busy director. Plus the art and history of chocolate brought together in a delicious new book. Also ahead.
AI is an assistant. It's here to amplify the human ability. It's going to get the grunt work out of the way, up-level the human condition.
How artificial intelligence is changing the workplace. We'll also hear about a restaurant that has become a must visit here in London, and we go through the weekend papers too. That's all to come this hour, live from London with me, Emma Nelson, on Monocle 24. To begin, I don't know what you do to relax or indeed what you wear when you're doing it. Some choose a soft cashmere jumper and a gentle walk. Others pull on their trainers and head out to the park. Well, my next guest has been the pioneer of burlesque, something that requires rather a lot more dressing up and dressing down in order to have fun. Founded in 2007 by Chaz Royal, the London Burlesque Festival is dedicated to the revival and the maintenance of what is a very, very popular art form. And I'm delighted to say that Chaz from the London Burlesque Festival joins me now in the studio. Welcome.
Hi.
Thank you very much indeed for coming in. We'll get to the sort of the magnitude and the sort of the wide-reaching nature of your festival in just a moment. But first, a few of us get a bit of an idea of what burlesque is about.
Yeah,
but could,
course,
for once and for all, you explain to us what exactly it is?
Well, you know, burlesque has changed over the years what it is now. You know, initially, I would say burlesque in the 1800s, here in Britain at least, was very much what pantomime is today. You know, the shows were full-on productions. They would rework old classic stories for the times. And it was really about the song, the dance, and women playing men and men playing women. You know, there was a lot of drag back then, and that's how they got away with it on stage, is by adding in, you know, the parody, the satire, and again, it was very popular. You know, these shows would happen at the end of the main theater productions, and often were more popular than the main theater productions. So you would often see every theater in London would have a burlesque on at the end of the night, and often selling out, you know. And from what I've read, you know, a lot of these shows were at full standing capacity at the back of the room. So we're talking, you know, anywhere between 2,000 to 4,000 seats per show. Now, again, you know, I think these shows were very popular for quite some time, but, you know, over the years probably fell out of popularity. So a lot of the producers brought these shows around the country, eventually making its way to America. I think after a few decades of it, you know, appearing in America, it probably fell out of fashion, and the Americans, you know, bastardized it and made it into something that it originally wasn't. It became more about the striptease by the 1930s and, you know, 40s and 50s, and probably by the 60s and 70s, it started to fall out of fashion again.
Was that because people suddenly thought, well, actually, this can be a rather seedy art form in many ways?
Yeah, I think in London as well, you know, going back, you know, to the 1950s, Soho, you know, there was a lot of burlesque shows on by then. Again, focusing more on the striptease aspect of it, places like the Raymond Review Bar, and, you know, there was lots of clubs around. So I would think, you know, the promoters would try to take it one step further. And, you know, once, you know, the customers started falling, you know, off, they would just make the shows more raunchier. And, you know, by the 1970s and 80s, burlesque, they weren't even using, you know, this word. It was so out of fashion that it just became all about the striptease and the lap dance clubs. And really, you know, by the 1990s, no one knew what burlesque was anymore. At least the younger generation didn't. So.
And then you came along.
Well, I'm just one of a few that, you know, tried to, create this resurgence. And, you know, I started reading about it, but, you know, for a few years, I started renting old VHS tapes. There was a company in the United States that started re-releasing some of the old stag movies and things like this from the 40s and 50s. I started seeing it more of a striptease aspect of it, but I didn't know anything about the real history of it until I started, you know, researching and reading books, and, you know, there was a real resurgence for it. So every few years, new books would be re-released, or, you know, people would sort of focus on what it was. And, you know, it's been a real sort of learning curve for me as well. So
what did you discover about the art form that you thought, actually, let's remove the really grim aspects that you talked about and turn it into something that can be utterly celebrated and smiled broadly when you see?
Well, I think, you know, for me anyways, I've been doing it for around 18 years now, producing shows. And, when I started, there wasn't a lot of people doing it. And, you know, it wasn't until I eventually started doing the London Burlesque Festival that there was a real resurgence for it in the UK. And it wasn't just the striptease. There was a lot of different performers that didn't know where they could perform. So a lot of these performers were sort of gravitating towards the burlesque shows. I would say, you know, a lot of the variety acts, the comedians, the novelty acts, circus type acts were all sort of ending up on burlesque shows. And so really it became more of a variety show. But I think, again, a lot of performers after a few years, they didn't want to be associated with just burlesque. They didn't want to be pigeonholed into a burlesque performer. So, you know, the word cabaret has really sort of evolved over the last 10 years as well. I would say if you ask someone what cabaret was 10, 15 years ago, they would have a real different way of looking at it. They would think maybe cabaret the movie, a chair dance, maybe, you know, an old, sort of bar in Blackpool for, you know, the drag scene, or, you know, there's so that word as well has a really wide range of meaning. I think burlesque and cabaret and variety, it all goes together, but, you know, burlesque has definitely changed over the years.
It makes you think, I wonder what it must have been like in 2007 when you've still got the hangover of people thinking that burlesque is a little bit seedy and nasty, and then there's you. Yeah. Chaz rocked up from Toronto and goes, all right, everybody, we're going to do this properly. What was it like trying to make it happen?
Yeah, I think there was a real backlash at first. There was a lot of people already doing burlesque in the UK that tried to, put a stop to it. A lot of people thought that they wouldn't like my brand of show, that, what I had to offer the UK wasn't really going to go down well. And it was quite the opposite. I think right from the start, people loved it. And, it gave me and a lot of other people an opportunity to showcase, you know, their talents in a way that just wasn't being presented properly in the UK.
What kind of people were coming up to you saying, Chaz, you've just given me a performing home?
Oh, I mean, performers from all over the world, once they realized there was a festival here, they gravitated towards it. So by, you know, the second year, it doubled in size and it just grew. We outgrew itself by 2010. We were running a full week. And by 2013, we outgrew the week and started doing a consecutive run for 10 days. Then it was 11 days, 17 days. And now it's a whopping 20 events. But now we don't run it consecutively. We spread it out over weekends over the course of a few months, just so we can really maximize the attendance on the weekends.
Clever idea of going about it. And there are enough people in London, arguably, to be able to go to at least one or two things and feel as if they've sort of had their little burlesque taste.
Oh yeah, I mean, people come in, you know, for the weekend, they see a few shows, maybe they, you know, they come to a few over the course of a few months. We do a variety of events, so it's really, we have some signature theme shows and showcases, so we try to, you know, educate the audience that it's not just about the striptease. We have shows that can cater to all different types of tastes. We have alternative shows. We have an all-tattooed show, you know, for tattooed lovers. Well, the performers are just heavily inked, and it's really about the body art as opposed to just the act itself. But yeah, so we have all these different theme shows on, and it just gives people the opportunity to say, oh, okay, well, that's something that I think I would like to see. So we have a danger strip show, which is all high risk acts, fire acts, aerial acts. And again, we're trying to offer, you know, a home for performers that might not be able to showcase these types of acts elsewhere. So
it's interesting because the London Burlesque show is advertised widely in the likes of Time Out, which is a sort of the big free magazine that goes around London. And it, you know, Time Out is a place which offers a little bit of space for the individual and the small, but Time Out is really the place where the mainstream can go to. And then you suddenly find yourself as a, you know, in the middle of Time Out being advertised. What does it feel like to having successfully brought a niche and sort of sidelined genre slap bang to the middle of the mainstream of the world's greatest city?
Yeah, I'm really proud of the event. It was the first festival of its kind in Europe, and it really sort of spearheaded the resurgence for it, I think, in the UK. And from that, you know, a lot of other festivals have cropped up over Europe. A lot of, you know, burlesque is quite popular in the capital now, dinner cabaret, and, you know, there's a lot of newcomer type shows. But I really feel like, you know, London Burlesque Festival is at the forefront of it. The mainstream media has covered us quite extensively over the years. We've had, you know, the BBC, television and radio cover us. Metro newspaper gave us the number one spot in all of the UK when we ran, a few years ago. But, you know, Time Out specifically, it's great. You know, I like to get the recognition. I feel like, you know, they've been quite supportive. We actually have a great Time Out offer on right now. If you check out the website, you'll see
it
at the top.
Give it a plug, Chaz.
Yeah, you'll see it. It's up to 70% off. Check it out, londonburlesquefest.com.
Brilliant. Chaz, just one last question. If you are a burlesque virgin, you've never been to anything before, and you're a little bit wondering, you know, you're wanting to start out, where do I go? I've got 3 months of this.
Sure.
Where do you go? When you've got your 70% discount,
where do you
spend that well-earned ticket?
Well, next month we launch at Bush Hall on April 13th, and that's our official preview. It's entitled The Peep Show. So it's going to be a taste of what we have on offer for the entire 3 months. And, you know, I would say that's a good start. That's a good focal point for if you're a burlesque virgin. So just come out, check out The Peep Show. All the shows are great. Throughout May, we're at Karma Sanctum Soho, which is a very boutique hotel. It's probably our smallest show, but we have 12 shows on offer throughout the month of May. And then our biggest shows are in June. We're at Conway Hall and back at Bush Hall. And our biggest shows would be Burlesque Gin and Jazz, Danger Strip Show. We have Best of the Fest on the 28th and 29th of June. And that's just a complete roundup of the best of the festival. So.
Plenty of time and opportunity. Chaz Royal, thank you very much indeed for joining us on Monocle 24. And go to their website. You just need to look up London Burlesque Festival for a list of all the fun. You're listening to Monocle 24. Still to come, an exploration of Coco when we go through the weekend papers. Stay with us.
When it comes to making friends and influencing others, smart nations know they need to show off their softer side. Join the Conga Line in our annual Soft Power Survey to find out where your nation stands. Playing now in the film section at monocle.com.
Approaching what's fast being called Art Madness season in the UAE, and at the heart of it, Art Dubai 2019, bringing together more than 90 galleries from more than 40 countries. Well, at the helm is Pablo Del Val. He's the artistic director of Art Dubai, and a week ahead of the opening, Pablo has taken a few minutes out to tell us all about it. Pablo, welcome to the programme.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
So your countdown is on. What are you looking forward to most about Art Dubai?
Well, I think for me, the most exciting thing is going to be how the visitors are going to interact with the amazing and huge amount of happenings that we're putting together. Not only the gallery halls with the participation of the galleries, but also the performances and the talks and the gigantic commission that we have constructed. I'm looking forward to an experience that is quite new for everybody, as we have in a way created, invented three new sections. We have linked everything in what we expect to be a very thoughtful way. There's going to be like a journey through different ideas and concepts that are very exciting. And I think the main aim is to pull out a project that is going to be discussing very exciting ideas and themes like how we build up communities.
You talk there about linking thoughtfully the enormity of the kind of art forms that you're trying to bring together. You brand yourself as being the most internationally diverse art fair. How do you go about shaping something when your remit is so big?
Well, this is precisely one of the challenges, no? Because it's exciting to know that in a way we are like on purpose middle-sized project in the sense that we have 90 galleries from 42 countries participating, and you can really do like a mapping of the world, but at the same time give visitors an unbelievable and exciting quality time experience. No? We have the right number of participants to give the visitors the sensation that they really can see and they can experience everything. So when we discuss this idea about a journey, it's because we're looking to geographies that, generally speaking, you don't see so often in the Western programming.
Tell us about them.
We look mainly to geographies that are called in nowadays the Global South. So we're really looking to Latin America, Africa, Middle East, South Asia, and Central Asia. So we have build up a programming around the fair that he's really discussing and looking to these geographies.
The fact that you are in the UAE, how does that shape the programming and indeed the approach to pulling together the fair, given the fact that if you're in London and you have Frieze or if you're in New York, you will have a different feeling to each fair? What is it about Art Dubai that so might be geographically specific?
Well, I think that to start with is where it takes place, which is Dubai. Dubai has more than 250 nationalities living here. So it's one of the most cosmopolitan cities in the world. And really, this means that we are working and living in harmony with many small communities, no? And this is, and the fair in a way reflects the DNA of Dubai. It really reflects this richness in cultures. It really shows how the art world is mapping in our days and how through Art Dubai we are able of showcasing a certain profile of geographies and communities that are not so often to be seen in the West, no? So this is part of what Dubai is. Dubai is a crossroad of cultures. It's a place where you pass through when you come from the East and you go to the West. We are managing to put together something that is very special in this way. So the energies that we have in Art Dubai are the energies that you don't find generally in the Western happenings or events. I mean, we are not a Eurocentric, North American drive type of project. We are much more looking to these geographies. And of course, I mean, we're in the Middle East and there's a certain look and there's a certain vibe and there's a certain way of showcasing what is produced in this part of the world.
Explain to us that special vibe.
The special vibe is that there's, first of all, the site. If you come to Dubai and you go to Madina Jumeirah, it's not a usual place where you expect an art fair to happen. It's not a convention center. It's something that architecturally is very exciting. So the art fair has a completely different look and feel to the other art fairs in the world. And this, to start with, gives visitors a completely different state of mind. They approach the programming, they approach the galleries with a completely different feeling. And I think that's one of the things that makes Art Dubai also very exciting.
They call this art madness in March in your part of the world. I mean, what happens to the area when Art Dubai lands? Does there suddenly get a vibe not just in the fair, but right across the patch?
Yes, we've been putting together Art Week for quite a few years now, and it's amazing how the entire city gets involved in it. You have everyone brings the best of the best. I mean, not only the participating galleries in Art Dubai, but most of the art spaces, foundation, and institutions in the city, no? So you breathe art everywhere you go.
So what new programming are you introducing this year?
We have new sections like Bawaba, which means gateway in Arabic, curated by a Cameroonian French curator, Elisa Tangana, which is going to be showcasing 10 solo projects coming from different geographies from the Global South. So you will have a chance of doing a mapping about artists that are living from or discussing issues that address the Global South. Then we have a new section also called UAE Now, which is going to be showcasing the grassroots of the country. It's very exciting to see how the youngsters are getting together, how the youngsters are building up platforms in a totally non-for-profit way. I mean, they are platforms that are not supported by the government. It's just by the force and the strength of networking. And I think it's going to be fantastic to see what the future of the local scene is. So this is curated by Munir Al-Sayer, which is an Emirati young curator. And then we will have Residence, which is also the second year that it happens, but it's the first time that it's devoted to a geography. So we have invited 12 artists from Latin America, and they've been in Dubai and Abu Dhabi between 6 and 8 weeks, producing the body of work that you will see showcased in the booth of the gallery in the fair. So it's very exciting to see how these sections connect to each other, and they're really discussing about Dubai as a production center.
And if we were to find you in one corner of Art Dubai between the 20th and the 23rd of March, where would we find you having the most fun?
Oh, God. I mean, I'm like a little bird that is running from one place to another, no? I think that we managed to put together a programming that allows people to interrelate in a peaceful pace. You have time to go through everything. Every situation is happening in a way that allows things to flow. And I try my best to be part of all of those things. But I think that I suppose it's by the end of the day when the night events, what we call Art Dubai After Dark, starts, is when you can find me more relaxed and more enjoyable.
Pablo Del Val, thank you very much indeed for joining us on Monocle 24. Time now for a regular Sunday brunch feature called Weekend Reads. Each week we hear from a different author about their latest work, and this week we hear from Chris Duffy. Chris is a creative technologist for Adobe. He leads Adobe's Creative Cloud's strategic development partnerships across the creative space. He's a noted AI and mobile speaker around the world, and he's recently published his first book. It's called Superhuman Innovation: Transforming Businesses with Artificial Intelligence. He spoke to Paul Osborne.
Last couple years, wanted to push the limits of what AI can do and went off the premise of don't tell me, show me. So that was kind of the core theme of superhuman innovation. Let's not just write a book about all of the great aspects and capabilities of AI, but let's actually show the world what AI can do. And so the book is primarily based from a technical standpoint on three layers. There's this conversational layer where it's doing voice recognition. And when I say voice recognition, that takes the form of a couple different ways: voice to voice, voice to text, and text to voice. And so created an interface to have that dialogue with an ensemble of technologies. The next layer up from that was summary analysis. So pointed APIs in the system towards resources, in many cases research papers, and then it would do a synopsis and a summary. And then the highest layer of the NLP was NLG, natural language generation, and that is in the news last couple weeks based off of the GPT-2 version coming out of OpenAI. And the premise and output of that is where the system can generate prose interpretation of where it's getting pointed at. So those are kind of the three layers of show me, don't tell me what AI can do.
Now, we'll get onto the implications of that idea of AI content creation in a moment, but it's worth pointing out that the book is a conversation between you and a sort of an AI co-author, isn't it?
We call this ensemble of technologies, AIMEE, which is metaphorical for and a combination of AI plus me. And I think that is the fundamental premise of superhuman innovation, that AI is an assistant. It's here to amplify the human ability. It's going to get the grunt work out of the way, up-level the human condition, both in terms of employees, customers, businesses, to allow them to do higher level thinking, invention, innovation.
We've been here before, though, haven't we? In the past, we've been told that the age of the robot was going to give us unlimited leisure time, and it never quite worked out like that. So can you understand why people are told, look, AI is going to change everything? They're going to do all the sort of, you say, the sort of the grunt work so that you don't have to. You can do more of the thinking and the innovating. That people might be a bit skeptical about that and think, well, we've been made these sort of promises in the past.
I would dissect that into two parts. One, that I think we go through this with any technology, right? There's this process of normalization. What is the technology? What is not the technology? What can it do? How do I implement it? And where do we start? And I think when we classify AI as robots, that is one aspect, but it is not current modern day AI. So some of the hopes of this book is to demystify what AI is and is not. Essentially, AI can be broken out into three levels: superintelligence, aka robots. And this is a credit to Hollywood and movies, where I think a lot of people associate AI with these higher level intelligence that are anthropomorphized and in robotic form. So that's much debate if that will happen and when that will happen. Pretty far out there, personally, I think. Next layer in is general intelligence, where that is the premise where AI and AI system will be equal intelligence to human intelligence. Much debate around that aspect as well. 50 years after the first AI summit, we still debate what is human intelligence, what is human consciousness, what are all the aspects of human emotion. So to recreate that holistically is a very big challenge. So modern day AI is narrow AI, and that's where this book focuses on, where we can leverage AI currently in our personal lives, in our business lives, and for consumers. So the promise of AI creating this utopia, I think, is centered around super intelligence. Narrow intelligence, I do strongly believe it is actionable. It is having a positive effect on the economy. Forbes recently just said by 2035, AI will increase productivity by 40% and will increase economic growth by 1.7% across 16 industries. So we're seeing tangible examples of AI as both a cost saving as well as a growth strategy.
You mentioned a little earlier the concept of AI content creation, and those recent discoveries said that it was potentially too dangerous to be released, this idea that AI could produce copy like a journalist that was to many people indistinguishable. And you can understand the nervousness at a time when there are armies of people generating fake stories. Ally that to a computer that can produce something that's indistinguishable, that's a very powerful weapon in the wrong hands.
I think that centers around, and this goes across all technologies, inherently technology is neither bad nor good. It's the intent and the human use of that technology. So we could even back up further and do an analysis of the source of where that content is getting created. The system, yes, generates, in the case of GPT-2, does generate content, but a human still has to orchestrate and have an intent and an objective. So with some of those concerns, it feels like we have to even go a step further upstream to address that. On the flip side, in terms of distribution of misinformation, and we've had this conversation since the early days of the printing press, it can be countered, an equally powerful system can be created with verified content to neutralize some of the downsides of something like that.
But you can understand why somebody, I'm going to sound like a terrible Luddite now, but you could understand why somebody who worries about the potential misuse of that and whose experience with AI to date has maybe been trying to persuade Siri to turn on a light bulb, that they might struggle a bit to think that this is the beginning of a bright future.
Yep. There are some big misconceptions and some big leaps in terms of the cultural conversation. What is exciting is we now have the computational power, we now have some new AI techniques, and we have this surplus of data. So the landscape is ripe for AI to unlock all of this unused data. The leap that is happening in the cultural conversation is AI is going to replace all jobs and create an existential threat. We're still having conversations on demystifying what AI is and what AI is not. Where can we start implementing it in businesses and overcoming some of the learning curves and the growth in getting some of the glitches out into the overarching ecosystem?
Chris Duffy there, speaking to Paul Osborne. And Chris's book, Superhuman Innovation, Transforming Businesses with Artificial Intelligence, is out now. Chocolate is a part of modern life. I hope it's part of your weekend. It's certainly part of mine. But it's something that's existed in the world's diets for thousands of years, from the spiced drinks sipped by the ancients to the artisan bars spiked with intriguing flavours, as well as a bar of the dirty cheap stuff now and again. Well, one woman has compiled modern and historical recipes and brought them together in one utterly delicious book. It's called Cocoa, and it's written by Sue Quinn, the food writer, and she joins us now on Monocle 24. Welcome to Sunday Brunch, Sue.
Thank you very much. Good morning.
Imagine you're putting chocolate in a Sunday brunch. What are you serving us? I thought I'd put you on the spot straight away.
Oh, you have put me on the spot straight away, haven't you? Goodness. Do you know what I think I'd do? I'd make something that wasn't in the book, and I'd make a chocolate toasted sandwich.
Go. Tell us about how to do this. I'm all ears.
Okay. You get your sandwich maker, and you pop in some bread, perhaps a bit of cheese. Now, depending on how edgy you want your sandwich to be, you could pop in some blue cheese or some cheddar. Maybe some chopped up dark chocolate and either some marmalade or some bacon. I love that. And then toast it up so that the cheese is lovely and melty, and you get that delicious combination of umami cheese, a bit of chocolate, a bit of sweet and savoury. It's really scrumptious.
So my mum always told me not to eat chocolate and cheese at the same time, but it would give me nightmares. But what you're doing is you're bringing together two incredibly important ingredients and combining them in a way that we probably wouldn't have thought of doing initially. And that is what chocolate has been used for forever, isn't it?
Absolutely, because a lot of us just think of chocolate as just having that one chocolatey flavour note that you find in the popular chocolate confectionery bars. But actually, if you take the cacao bean, it's got 600 or more aroma molecules, which means basically that's what gives chocolate its flavour. And if you get a good chocolate that respects those flavours and doesn't cover them up with sugar and vegetable fats and all that type of stuff, you've got a really complex flavour, kind of like a kaleidoscope of flavors, and you can harness those to match with other ingredients. So some types of cacao bean have quite distinctive dairy notes in it, or quite distinctive fruity notes, or herby or spicy notes. And if you harness those and pair them with other ingredients, you can enhance those other ingredients or provide contrast. So it's much more complex and versatile than a lot of people consider.
Your book goes right back to the Aztecs and then brings us up bang up to date. But one thing that you examine is what it is about cocoa and then chocolate, which makes us all go weak at the knees. It is something that is an incredibly emotional food, isn't it?
It is. That's the million-dollar question, and people have been trying to put their finger on why we're all so bewitched by it. It's a combination of factors. It's like all the planets have aligned in terms of the different aspects of chocolate to make it almost irresistible to a lot of people, not everybody. So, you know, it's a combination, firstly, of that sugar and fat. Some people say it's similar to the combination of sugar and fat in breast milk, so we're almost hardwired to like it. There's also the fact that, you know, we're all a bit addicted to sugar these days, so that also appeals. And also there's the fact that it melts at body temperature. So we put a piece of chocolate on our tongue and it almost melts instantly. And scientists say that that particular melting at body temperature is something that our brains love. There's also all those different compounds in it, which are bliss molecules, sometimes known as bliss molecules. Anandamide is one of them. And they react with receptors in our brain and basically make us happy. So it's got all that stuff going for it.
But these bliss molecules weren't always triggered, were they? When they were first, in your book, you talk about when chocolate or cocoa was first introduced in London and no one would drink it because it was pretty disgusting. And then, and how the Spanish who introduced chocolate to cocoa to Europe were told that it was more a drink for pigs than a drink for humanity.
Well, that's right. I mean, the drink that the Aztecs and the ancient civilizations before them drank is obviously very, very different to the chocolate that we have today. That it was gritty because they didn't have the machinery to grind it up into a lovely smooth paste, and they didn't have sugar, although they did sometimes add honey. But it was more a bitter, gritty drink, and it would have had those compounds that I mentioned before would have been quite powerful because they weren't heating the bean, they were grinding it raw and drinking it just with water added. So it would have been very, very strong. So they may well have had much more, you know, strong effect than perhaps eating a bar of dairy milk. But then once cacao or cocoa beans found their way to Europe, we started adding ingredients that were a bit more familiar to us, like sugar, like cinnamon, like other spices that we knew, and it gradually evolved into something that we were familiar with, and we very, very quickly got a taste for it.
And then it becomes a drink of pure luxury, that this is not something that the poor can drink. The recipes that you have are recipes for the royalty drinking their chocolate. Marie Antoinette's amazing recipe for hot chocolate with orange blossom and almonds. This becomes something which is purely for the elite, and it is a taste of pure luxury.
Absolutely, because, I mean, remember at this time, cacao is only grown in a very small, narrow band around the equator. So at that time, in the 17th century or the 18th century, it was outrageously expensive. You could really only afford it if you were the uber wealthy. So chocolate was a drink of luxury for the royal families and the very rich and wealthy in Europe, and it was a status symbol. If you could afford to serve chocolate drinks to your friends, it meant that you were very, very wealthy. Marie Antoinette is purported to be one of the first chocoholics, and I have a slight problem with that reference, because it's always women that tend to be accused throughout history of not being able to cope with their chocolate craving.
It's something that you actually have a whole chapter about in your book, and there's this idea of chocolate being used as a sort of a thing to tame women.
Well, yes. I mean, to keep them happy with a glass of chocolate. I mean, there was a bit of that. But I mean, certainly Marie Antoinette was. She loved her chocolate. She brought a chocolate maker with her from Austria to France when she came to marry Louis XVI, and he would include ingredients in that were fashionable, you know, like orange blossom water was very fashionable. Almonds were quite exotic as well. So I think it was as much, she obviously found it delicious, but it was as much a status symbol as it was a drink, I think.
Sue Quinn, thank you very much indeed. And Cocoa, An Exploration of Chocolate with Recipes, is out later this month. You're listening to Monocle 24. It's Sunday Brunch with me, Emma Nelson, and we go through the papers in just a moment.
Stay one step ahead of the breaking news.
People are saying, look, enough is enough. The middle class is getting squeezed and squeezed and squeezed. The rich are getting richer. And they're saying, look, this is not a fair game.
Hear industry-leading insights from our experts.
When tech companies have problems, they can go south very quickly. BlackBerry, Nokia, nowhere near the companies they used to be, but both were invincible. Nokia boasted that they were one of the first companies on the planet to sell 1 billion of their products.
And catch up with Monocle's Bureau around the world. Every weekday at noon London time, keep your appointment with The Briefing on Monocle 24.
And a very warm welcome if you've just joined us. This is Sunday Brunch. It's Emma Nelson here. And whatever you are doing this weekend, wherever you are in the world, I hope that a quick stroll to the newspaper stand is part of your weekend routine. To help you decide which one you're going to buy, well, Carol Rogers, film writer and producer, joins me in the studio. She's done the heavy lifting when it comes to the papers. Welcome back, Carol.
Good morning. Thank you.
We have to immediately address the way that the papers have covered the killing in New Zealand.
Yes, we do. It's a shocking atrocity, and the shining light coming out of New Zealand at the moment is a prime minister who it can only be admired with her. She started the conversation on gun control from the first step, and that's so important because world leaders usually don't want to start the conversation. And she's leading with that, and I hope it is of some comfort to those involved in this tragedy to know that there's a prime minister who wants to ensure that this doesn't happen again.
Has there been any reaction in the papers to the way that Jacinda Ardern has behaved, given the fact that she has very much taken control of the narrative from the word go? And it seems to be, what I've quite admired about her is it seems to become an issue about guns and not about who is targeting whom, which is what it becomes anywhere else in the world, especially in the US.
Yes, and you're absolutely right on that. It is a gun issue, and also, which was very interesting in the Observer, is the article at the end of it goes on to say it's being addressed, gun control is being addressed, and accessibility to weapons is being addressed. Because of far-right extremist networks getting control of weapons. And that followed on and has actually made the cover of the FT with deadly New Zealand mosque attacks spark new fears over far-right violence. So all of this is interlinked, and that's why it's wonderful that she's leading with that.
One thing that's also been addressed or has been noticed is that familiar case, which is when someone goes and does something absolutely catastrophic, which has been the case here, is that the suspect is, you'd argue, about half of the time they are not on the list of any suspects, to watch out for. And this has been the case here. Authorities say that the Observer in Australia and New Zealand have been asked to review why the suspect was not linked on any counter-terrorism watch list. He identified himself as a member of online far-right extremism networks, and the massacre was live-streamed on social media. And this is someone who was hiding in plain view.
Yes, he was indeed. It's but still a lone wolf. And as far as the streaming the whole situation is horrific. The fact that this was streamed, it was a lone wolf, and I don't understand, really. Reading the papers today, they aren't really covering that side of this mass murder being streamed live. And I think that's something else that needs to be addressed.
Okay, let us move on. We're in the United Kingdom, therefore we must talk about Brexit. This week we've seen what I think one correspondent who's come into Monocle in the past said this was a series ender. And I argued that it wasn't. And I think I'm right, because this thing just keeps going on and on and on. But one interesting article I found in The Observer is revealed, front page, EU wargaming for fall of May government. We cover an awful lot of messes here in the United Kingdom, in the British Parliament. But suddenly the focus is now on Brussels and the politicking there.
Indeed. It was quite a shock to have that on the cover of The Observer this morning. And it's been leaked what Brussels plans to do. What they're looking for is they're trying to maneuver Theresa May into a checkmate position, and whether she'll stay or she'll go. It says a key official in a bid to block changes to the deal, how much the delay will be. It's a game changer. It's a game changer for Brussels to be on the offensive. And it says the ebbing trust within her own party is matched by the mood in Brussels, where, according to the leaked notes, one diplomat said at the Friday meeting, the clear feeling is that there is a complete lack of confidence in the British Prime Minister to deliver on this deal.
Unless you're Theresa May, indeed. You think you're fine. Yes. Unbelievable tenacity. I think someone's got to sort of give her an award or test her genes to see what it is. And it's interesting, just reading more deeply into the Observer article, and you see the headlines, EU wargaming for fall of May government. That on first impression thinks that the EU are trying to plot to place her in a checkmate position, make a position absolutely untenable. Actually, if you read the article, it's not 100% reflected in what they're really up to. It's saying that actually a diplomatic note of a meeting of EU ambassadors and senior officials reveals an attempt to make sure that any new prime minister cannot immediately unpick the withdrawal agreement should May be replaced in the months ahead. Now, that is not what the headline is saying. What they're doing is they're just making sure that a hardline Brexiteer doesn't come in and drive a cart and horses through what's been negotiated for the last 2 years.
Yeah, indeed. Indeed.
Okay, next story. What is it? Let's. Where do you want to go to next?
Okay, the next story we've got...
I think we're on the New York Times.
We're on the New York Times.
The flawed system of US college admissions. Standardized test scores are manufactured, transcripts made up, high-stakes admissions decisions are issued based on fabricated extracurricular activities, ghost-written personal essays, and the size of the check written by the parents of the applicant.
Okay.
Okay.
You can hang on to that.
That's pretty heavy going. So basically, there's... Oh, good. Oh, look, what great surprise.
Yeah, this is...
The elite are buying their way into the posh university.
This has been going on for a very long time, and it's about time that it's been outed, and surprisingly, it's being outed by the FBI, because it is a federal offence. What they've been doing with elite universities is there have been payoffs to these universities. Parents have been paying to have their children's scores changed so they can get into universities. There are teenagers getting into universities on sports scholarships when they don't even play the sports. So this has got to stop, and it has been going on for a very long time. It's a small percentage of individuals who do this, but the bottom line is it's taking a place for somebody who academically should be in that position, but financially can't meet those requirements. So it's unfair, to say the least. And I'm delighted that it's been outed.
It's one of those things, though, because that people suspect has been happening forever. Mm. It goes from everywhere, from admissions to school to admissions into workplaces and this, that and the other. It is, you know, if your friend's friend of a friend, then guess what? You might get your foot in the door. But the fact is that they're quoting lawsuits against the likes of Harvard. Now, when you have the reputation of something like Harvard and, University of California, Berkeley, and all these names that are held up in such esteem, they are the educational establishments of presidents. What does that say about the way that people will look at these institutions in the future?
Well, it is my it is where I attended university, and I know getting into Harvard with loans and grants and subsidies and grades is a very difficult, tedious process. So, for me, it does stick in my craw, so to say, when for a family to come in and pay their way through, and that has to stop. They have to open it to all individuals with academic achievement to get in.
And when you were there, was there any indication that there were quite a few people who possibly their status would suggest that they might be find it easier to get into Harvard, but their academic achievement was laid bare the minute they walked through the door?
Well, that's outed very, very quickly all the time, and even down to some US presidents who have had the privilege of being educated at Harvard or Yale. then not being able to spell potato is probably the best way to put it. And you wonder how on earth they're getting through this. And all of this is now coming out thanks to the FBI supporting it with evidence.
And one thing that's being noticed in this article is a sociologist is quoted as saying that the bribery crisis simply reflects the problems in broader society. I think that as America has become more and more unequal, says this sociologist, affluent parents have become desperate to pass on their privilege to children and avoid downward mobility at all costs. It came out a few weeks ago that the United States is the most socially and economically divided country on earth, despite being one of the wealthiest, if not the wealthiest. How accurate a reflection of American society is this? Is this university bribery issue?
It is accurate. It's when you look at it, when you look, for example, someone like President Obama being able to get into Harvard. He was from a single parent family. He was out of Hawaii. So you won't have 40,000 people from Hawaii applying to Harvard. So it, and because he was of color, he was able to be moved up and had a fairer chance to get in. And look at what a wonderful example he's been of that process and how it works. It's but for the elite paying their way to get in, that has to stop. There's no upward mobility if people are going to be buying their way through education.
Okay, finally, talking about upward mobility and changes, we have Ralph Fiennes, the actor, has been accused of not being politically correct by stating that Bond should not be a woman. Celebrity aside, it opens up the age-old argument about whether a system that works, or if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Namely, have a massively misogynist bloke driving around in Aston Martin with large watch, making passionate love to women who get shot 2 minutes later. Whether that should actually change, and we should have a girl in charge instead.
Okay,
so you write films for a living.
It's yes. Well,
so
what
should we do, Dr. Carol?
It's I really felt for Ralph Fiennes. Being the target of ground-to-air missiles by making this comment. He's absolutely right that Bond is a masculine character that comes from history, and this is old film. Bond is a brand. To change that, it just wouldn't work because it's such a masculine character. That said, you look at Doctor Who, where you could change Doctor Who into a woman, and it didn't really make all that much difference. But to change Bond into Lady Bond, it just wouldn't work. So it's a shame that he's been getting such flack for that comment, which is a legitimate criticism, really, an opinion.
Carol Rogers, thank you so much for joining us on Monocle 24. You're listening to Sunday Brunch. Welcome back to Sunday Brunch. If you've just joined us, a very warm welcome. And we are going to have a final brunch-themed item. And we're keeping it close today. We're keeping it close with our neighbours. The Chiltern Firehouse is just down the road from us here at Midori House. It's 5 years old this year, and the food is continuing to grow and still be ridiculously delicious if you're able to get a table. Richard Foster is the head chef at the Chiltern Firehouse, and I'm delighted to say he's coming to the studio to tell us a little bit more. Welcome, Richard.
Hi there.
How is the Chiltern Firehouse? It exploded onto London's scene a few years ago. Everybody rushed through the doors, and has it settled down into something quite lovely now?
I feel like it's settled down. I feel like the business is more consistent. I feel like we're expanding and growing into a more of a neighbourhood restaurant. I just feel it's, you know, at the start, it was had a bit of a stigma that it was like completely impossible to get a table. That's not the case. Like, you know, we're incredibly busy, but Yeah, it's an approachable restaurant.
Was that an approach? It is a lovely restaurant to go to. If it's one of those places, though, that, like you say, it's funny that you described this as having a stigma when it first started, because you couldn't move in the newspapers for people falling in and out of cars late at night at the Chiltern Firehouse. Did you have to actively say, right, we're going to not foster that kind of clientele anymore and we're going to try and keep it a little bit local? Or was it just a natural evolution that things moved on and then you could settle into what you really wanted to be?
Yeah, it was a completely natural evolution. You know,
quite a refreshing one, I'd hope, as well.
Yeah, it's nice, you know, not to be judged just on being constantly fully booked, you know. Like, the Chiltern Firehouse for me is like a really, really fantastic night out in London. It's so fun. The moment you walk in, the feeling when you walk into the room, it's so forward, so electric, and the service is so fun.
And also, the food's not bad. It's pretty delicious.
Yeah, I like to think so.
So your head chef, what are you pushing forward now in the Chiltern House to make sure it maintains its reputation for serving really lovely food?
We're pushing at the moment we're kind of like revisiting our grill and trying to evolve the way we're cooking on our grill over smoke and fire. That's like a project over the next few months.
What should we look forward to?
Yeah, and we have an amazing wood oven that we've never really fully utilised, and we're going to introduce wood in there, and we're going to start cooking in the wood oven, but focusing more on like a neighbourhood menu as well.
How often does that happen to a chef? I know it happens in my kitchen that I get a wonderful gadget and it sits there looking beautiful, and then I walk past it every day for about 3 years.
Yeah.
And then I suddenly think, I've actually forgotten that it was there. Did you have that moment with the wood oven?
Yeah, it was a chat that me and Nuno were having a couple of weeks ago, actually. And we were just like, what are we doing with it? And then we actually realised we're doing nothing with it.
It's sitting there getting a little dusty.
It's just sitting there looking pretty, yeah, and getting dusty, exactly.
So what are you going to do?
We are thinking about doing small like pizzettes and like baking goods and maybe like pastries to order in there. But yeah, at the moment it's very early doors with that.
Early doors.
But I'm excited about it. And the team's excited. They're really, really excited.
And what are the clientele loving at the minute? What do they always go bananas for?
Well, they always go to bananas for the crab donuts.
Which you've brought in.
Yeah.
Which look gorgeous.
Yeah, it's kind of a classic. We have like a kind of the Firehouse classics now, and we kind of come on the menu and come off the menu. The crab donuts here is like the third evolution of it, so it's the same dish in principle.
How do you very briefly, we've run out of time, but how do you evolve a crab donut?
Just trying to change the fillings of what I enjoy, what I think that people like to eat, like on the go, fast food sort of thing, and just make it fun.
And something delicious to nibble when you're coming. When you're coming after a long day at work, you come in and someone offers you a crab donut. All is right with the world. Richard Foster, thank you so much for joining us on Monocle 24. That's all we have time for on this edition of Sunday Brunch. Produced and studio managed by George McDonough, our thanks to him. And to our researcher, Mariana Lagrasta, too. Coming up, Robert Forster is on the Midori House Sessions. And then from midday, it's the Monocle Weekly. But for now, from me, Emma Nelson, it's goodbye. Thank you very much for listening.